criticism, plain and simple. And frankly, we shouldn't be putting up with it. And I think the Prime Minister and indeed the Home Secretary has done the right thing. I was disappointed with Keir Starmer saying he's deeply concerned. I think it was more than deep concern. It would have been to the Jewish community, I have no doubt.
Right. I mean, the Wireless Festival hasn't yet publicly responded to the news. Was there a sense, Maxwell, in your mind, that perhaps they were hoping the government that the festival might just drop him?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, from the government's perspective, I think that would have been the best option. They seem to be getting into kind of judgment here on politics, but I think Carl's right that the Prime Minister struggles to make those executive calls. But I think the festival already knew. They'd already issued a statement. They've had huge sponsors drop out over this stuff, and I think they did want to gun on with it fundamentally.
Right. Well, Maxwell Marlowe, Director of Public Affairs at the Adam Smith Institute, and Carl Turner, Labour MP, thank you very much for joining us today on The Times at One to discuss the news that actually permission to Kanye West to come to the UK has been blocked by the government. That's all we have time for on The Times at One. Thank you to The Times at One production team. Asma Mir is here standing in for Jane and Fee.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You're listening to Asma Mir on Times Radio. It's a very busy show today. A lot of breaking news coming up. Donald Trump says a whole civilization will die tonight if Iran doesn't reopen the Strait of Hormuz. We'll look at the West's options as military planners meet in London. Kanye West has been blocked from entering the UK after his controversial signing as the headlining act for the Wireless Festival. We'll speak to the charity Bipolar UK and hear how the rapper changed over time. Self-swab kits are meant to give women another option if they're assaulted or raped. So why do police say that they're a risk to victims? We'll hear from an MP who wants the kits banned and an organisation promoting their use. Plus, my big guest after 3:30 is the fitness coach Elizabeth Davis on her book, Training for Your Old Lady Body. Before all of that, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's understood Kanye West been blocked from entering the UK, with ministers deciding his visit would not contribute to the public good. There's been pressure on the government to act ever since the star was booked as headliner for this summer's Wireless Festival. But campaign groups were against it because of his previous anti-Semitic comments and remarks celebrating Nazism. Phil Rosenberg is president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews.
I think it's a shame that the government has had to step in and the Wireless Festival organisers did not do the decent thing themselves. It's very disappointing. But, you know, we thank the government for taking action in this case.
Donald Trump has warned a whole civilization will die tonight unless Iran reaches a deal on reopening the Strait of Hormuz. There's just 11 hours to go before his deadline. Meanwhile, the US has carried out strikes on military targets on Iran's key oil export terminal, Karg Island. Sarah Baxter is the director of the Marie Colvin Center for International Reporting and says there's a sense of dread.
I did wake up with something of a pit in my stomach with this concept of the doomsday clock ticking, and it feels a kind of Armageddon-like this morning, because Trump's threat to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age, you know, it's only got a few hours to go. And indeed, you know, the first skirmishes, or worse, may have already started in the Strait of Hormuz.
Meanwhile, the cost of an oil barrel is now around £83, up more than 50% since the Iran war started. The head of the International Energy Agency has called it the worst oil crisis in history. An ex-Facebook worker suspected of downloading 30,000 private pictures and is accused of designing a program to avoid internal checks. A London-based engineer has been sacked and is on police bail. Meta discovered an alleged breach more than a year ago and has updated its security systems. The Health Secretary says the government could have built a few hospitals with the estimated £3 billion it's cost to cover the long-running dispute with resident doctors in England. They've begun a six-day strike, their 15th walkout in the last 3 years. Dr. Melissa Ryan is on the picket line in Nottingham. She explains why doctors feel they have to take action.
It's simply that there aren't enough doctors. And our worry is in an understaffed NHS, and we have doctors leaving for better paying conditions, but also just because they're burnt out or they can't get a job at all. My worry is that it's the patients that are going to suffer, because if there aren't enough doctors, those waiting lists are only going to increase.
Interest rates on some student loans will be capped at 6% from September after criticism over rising repayment costs. The government says it'll protect graduates on plans 2 and 3 from inflation pressures linked to the Middle East conflict. An American billionaire has offered to buy Universal Music Group for almost £50 billion. Bill Ackman, a prominent supporter of Donald Trump, has proposed a cash and stock deal to take control of the business, which runs Abbey Road Studios and labels like EMI and Island Records. And a long-standing Waitrose employee who was sacked after tackling a shoplifter has been offered a job at a rival supermarket chain. Walker Smith confronted a shoplifter who was attempting to steal a bag of Easter eggs. Waitrose then dismissed him. Now the chairman of Iceland, Lord Richard Walker, has said Mr. Smith is welcome to a job with us. For a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Asma Mir in for Jane and Fee until 4 this afternoon. It's a pretty busy news afternoon. Coming up, Donald Trump has posted on social media threatening that, and I quote, "A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again," unquote, unless Iran reopens the Strait of Hormuz. The latest deadline, in case you've lost track, is 1 a.m. our time. We'll ask a former Royal Navy officer how likely that is. In the last half hour or so, the government has blocked Kanye West from travelling to the UK to perform at a music festival after Jewish groups said he should not be allowed to because of his anti-Semitic remarks. What next for that festival? We'll ask an anti-knife crime campaigner what he thinks of the government's new plan to reduce knife crime in schools. And slightly lighter, you know that crazy marathon that takes place in the Sahara and goes on forever? It's happening right now as you languish in the garden or at your desk, wherever you are. We're going to try to understand its appeal with a woman who has actually taken part. Now, you can get in touch the usual ways. I'm sure you will have plenty to say about a lot of the stuff we're talking about this afternoon. But specifically, I suppose, on Kanye West, because that is the most updated story. The government has just blocked Kanye West from travelling to the UK. So what does that mean for the Wireless Festival? What does that mean for people like Kanye West, who perhaps try to salvage their reputation, but it hasn't worked? What should the organisers have done before? Should they have consulted with the Jewish community? Many people say that they should have. Do any of you think that he should still be allowed to come because he has apologised and he has offered to meet Jewish groups? You can get in touch the usual ways. You can text 87222. Start your message with the word Times. You can WhatsApp on 0333 003 2353, or you can email studio@times.radio. Right, let's have a look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. These are clearly going to keep changing. But number three right now is France train crash, driver killed and 27 injured in a lorry collision. This is a TGV train that was carrying 243 passengers when it hit a lorry on a level crossing in the Pas-de-Calais region. The second most read story, and the first, of course, they're both about Iran, but the second is Iran's supreme leader unconscious and receiving treatment in Qom. A diplomatic memo has revealed the location of Mojtaba Khamenei. He was wounded in the same US-Israeli airstrike that killed his father. But the most read piece on the Times website is the Iran war latest. It's the live page, of course, that has all the latest details on the conflict, including the threat from the US president, which came in the last hour or so. You can read all those articles at thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. You can just get one by going to thetimes.com/subscribe. Now, if you want a sneak preview of what's coming up in tomorrow's Times newspaper, even before it's gone to the press, listen to Kate Borsay, of course, on Evening Edition as she brings you tomorrow's Times Today. Every day just before nine, Kate goes through the best bits of tomorrow's paper with one of the paper's most senior editors. So don't miss that. Right, it's 8 minutes past two now. Let's get into all the various news stories that have been developing over the last couple of hours. An entire civilization will die tonight if Iran doesn't reopen the vital Strait of Hormuz. That is what Donald Trump has said, his latest post on Truth Social. The US president has set a deadline, it's another deadline, of 1 a.m. tonight for a deal, saying that Iran will be bombed back to the Stone Ages if there is no agreement. Now, Western military officials are meeting at a base in North London to discuss plans for the strait if the fighting stops. A fifth of the world's oil, as I'm sure you know by now, is usually shipped through the Middle Eastern waterway, which has been closed since the beginning of the war. Let's speak to John Foreman, who's a former Royal Navy officer who served as defence attaché to Moscow and Kyiv. Good afternoon to you, John.
Good afternoon, sir.
We're going to talk about the meeting today in a second, obviously, and you know, get your expertise and insight on that. But what do you make of what Donald Trump has posted on social media? You know, we're no stranger to the hyperbole that he indulges, but saying that a whole civilization will die, never to be brought back unless you do what I say. What do you think is going on in his head?
It strikes me that the Iranians, when they responded to one of his previous comments, called his statements helpless, nervous, stupid. I think on top of that, say rather desperate. We've seen 2 weeks of increasing hyperbole and outlandish rhetoric from the president, as he's realised the consequences of his own actions, stumbling into a war which the United States wasn't properly prepared for. He's realised that, you know, he needs to get the straits open, and he's reverting to threats against Iran, which I'm not sure are going to work. So you have the Iranians probably laughing at him, and as Trump gets out of bed in the morning, he decides to fire up another missive. But I think threatening entire civilizations has gone beyond, should we say, threatening bridges and power plants and desalination stations, desalination sites, rushing to levels of threatening genocide and war crimes.
And, I mean, clearly he's running out of patience. He's had several deadlines. He keeps, you know, extending them. And then, he picks up his phone and he threatens all sorts. Presumably, I mean, you know, you're here to talk about the Strait of Hormuz, which is exactly what is exercising Donald Trump. Presumably, is it starting to pinch already for him, or people telling him that actually, if we don't get this back open in the next couple of weeks, you know, people are really going to feel this?
Well, I think so. You know, the other thing I would say about the statement about civilization is contradictory. At the beginning, he says the whole civilization will die. And then he says at the end, God bless the great people of Iran. So he's not quite clear about what he said. But again, the consequences of his actions, he thought after Venezuelan abduction of Maduro that he could just swagger in, knock over the Iranian regime, achieve regime change and move on and bring peace as a great peacemaker. But he's realised, I think, the limit of American power. He can't change regimes by air. He failed to build alliances. He failed to prepare the world or the world economy for his actions. And all this is now landing at his lap. And that's why his rhetoric and his statements are getting more outlandish. The Americans have already moved to try and ease the oil shortages by unsanctioning Russian shadow fleet vessels so that oil afloat could get to the market. But you know, as you said, in your introduction, a fifth of oil has come through the Strait of Hormuz. That is shut down to a trickle. And the consequences are already being felt in the Far East. I think they're about to come bite us in Europe. So the whole situation is running out of its control. And that's why I think his statements are getting more daft by the day.
Mm. So tell us a bit about what you think can be achieved at this meeting that's happening today. So Western military officials meeting at a base in North London, discussing plans for the Strait of Hormuz if and when the fighting stops. What kind of things, just on a very general level, will they be discussing?
Well, obviously, this follows the meeting chaired by Yvette Cooper last week, where the Foreign Office was very cagey about who they invited to try and discuss the issues of Strait of Hormuz. But think the Prime Minister said this is all about making the strait accessible and safe after the fighting is finished. In the back of that previous conversation, I'm not sure when that's going to happen. And then even Macron said military options are unrealistic. So the politicians last week came up with, shall we say, more sanctions on Iran, more pressure on Iran, talking about working with the International Maritime Organization and sharing information. But I don't think fundamentally the military plans can achieve much at the moment while the fighting continues. And even then, they're not prepared to force open the straits militarily because of the risk to ships and, you know, sailors. So really we're looking down the line at some stage in the future to try and, you know, act ducks in a row when and if the war between Iran and the United States finishes.
Mm. What would that look like? I mean, you know, obviously we're concentrating very much on the here and now because we're constantly being kind of having to confront it through, you know, Donald Trump's actions, his deadlines, his posts on social media. But if and when it does reopen, that is obviously going to be a very difficult, very dangerous job to keep it open. Who would actually be doing that?
Well, I think we have some models from the past. I mean, I did it myself back in the 1980s when we escorted friendly shipping, should we say, back and forth through the Straits of Hormuz. There were also mine hunters in the region to ensure the straits weren't mined. And that was an international coalition of the French and the British and the Americans and the Italians and others. And I think that's probably the sort of construct we're looking now in the future to say that if and when the fighting stops and the Iranians agree not to missile or try and attack friendly shipping, merchant shipping or warships in the Straits of Hormuz, then you might see naval vessels back in there. And I think they have three clear tasks. One would be surveilling or having surveillance of the region through maritime patrol aircraft and drones. Secondly, would be patrolling or escorting ships back and forth to provide confidence to the merchant vessels that it's safe to do so. And I think third would be mine countermeasures. And you've seen reports of a British Royal Fleet auxiliary ship being fitted out for that currently in Gibraltar. So I think the time that's going to take implies that the military planners aren't expecting a ceasefire in the very near future. And they were talking about a few weeks or months away rather than days.
Really interesting. John, thank you very much for joining us. That's John Foreman, who's a former Royal Navy officer who served as defence attaché to Moscow and Kyiv. We're going to move on and talk about knife crime, but just lots of you getting in touch about Kanye West, and I will come to those tweets and WhatsApps and texts. If you haven't heard, Kanye West has been blocked by the government from coming to the UK to perform at the Wireless Festival, which was going to take place in London between the 10th and the 12th of July. The government say that his visit is not conducive to the public good. Is that the right decision? Most of you saying it is. You know how to get in touch, 87222. Start your message with the word Times, or you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio. Now, hundreds of schools in knife crime hotspots will be given new support to stop children getting involved in serious violence. It's part of the government's new plan aiming to halve knife crime within the next 10 years. Officials say the number of people stabbed to death is down by 27%, and knife crime is also falling. But there are fears that the number of those carrying knives is rising. Let's speak to Patrick Green, who's the chief executive of the Ben Kinsella Trust. Good afternoon to you, Patrick.
Good afternoon.
Can you explain then what this will actually mean? There's going to be 250 schools that are involved, and the kind of things, this is not definitive list, but the kind of things that are going to they're going to get help with are mentoring for high-risk pupils and deploying chaperones on school routes. How effective do you think those kind of things will be?
Well, first of all, it is great to see money being and resources being placed, given to schools, and particularly those schools which are in areas where there's high levels of knife crime. And it's great to see that we're doing far more much earlier to stop knife crime. There's been a lot of talk recently about legislation and enforcement, but, you know, if we really want to stop knife crime, we've got to get upstream and tackle it much earlier. What these measures will do is for the schools in those areas which have got high concentration of knife crime, it gives them those valuable resources that you just mentioned, tailored around the individual needs of the young people involved. And it gives gives schools the opportunity to do far more for young people in environments which young people trust, to help them develop better understanding of knife crime and better ways to keep themselves safe other than carrying knives, which they will misguidedly think is the way that they protect themselves.
And official figures, apparently, number of people stabbed to death, which is still a horrendous statistic. It's down by 27% and knife crime is also falling. What might you put that down to, do you think? What are we getting right?
We're starting to get much more concerted action around knife crime. We've tended to treat knife crime as a very simple issue in terms of just tackling it with just purely enforcement. I think what we're now seeing from the new government, and we'll shortly see their plan, which is to be released in the next 24 hours to have knife crime, is more concerted action across schools, supporting those, trying to reinvigorate a youth service which has been decimated over the last 15 years, giving police extra resources and updating legislation and doing more to stop habitual knife carriers, those people who've been arrested, punished carrying knives, but still go on to carry knives much later afterwards. So it's a concerted effort across a number of fields. And I think, what we're seeing is some very positive early results from the government's interventions.
Okay. Patrick, thank you very much for that. Thank you for talking to us. That is Patrick Green, who's the chief executive of the Ben Kinsella Trust. Some breaking news, not entirely unpredictable on Times Radio, that the Wireless Festival has now been cancelled following the row over Kanye West. I mean, Kanye West was the main, he was the headliner. If you were to have gone on the Wireless website, as I did just before the programme, but half an hour ago, and clicked on lineup, the only person that they had on there was Kanye West. Obviously, there would have been other bands, and other acts, but the entire thing has now been cancelled. And what a mess, really. I know that one of the organisers was on the radio this morning talking about, oh, yes, it probably was a bit of a mistake. We probably should have consulted with Jewish groups before we booked Kanye West. That might be a mistake that comes back to haunt us. I'm paraphrasing here. And indeed it has, because without Kanye West, whom the Home Office have blocked, they've blocked him from coming to the UK, without him, there is no Wireless Festival. So I think there's a lesson in that, is there not? Of course, all ticket holders will be refunded, but the event itself that was going to go ahead between the 10th and 12th of July in Finsbury Park in London is not going ahead. You know how to get in touch, 87222, start your message with the word Times. You can email as well, studio@times.radio, or you can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. We are going to be talking about the whole Kanye West story a bit later on in the programme, in about 15 minutes or so, but there's a lot of you getting in touch already, and you can continue to do so. If you are just turned on the radio, Kanye West, about an hour ago, was blocked by the Home Office travelling to the UK to attend the Wireless Festival. And in the last couple of minutes, of course, Wireless Festival has been completely cancelled. Right, coming up, what is the furthest that you could run? 5K? A marathon? How about 250 kilometres in the Sahara? That is next. But don't worry, you don't have to do it. It's 2:21.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
As the clock ticks closer to Donald Trump's threat of unleashing hell on Iran, will we witness the fury of a president who's run out of patience, or will it be a Taco Tuesday? We'll unpack the latest diplomatic efforts between Tehran and Washington with the former British diplomat in the Middle East, Arthur Snell. And we'll discuss the day's biggest news stories with the journalist and author Yasmin Alibi Brown and the communications consultant Liam Deacon.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
McGriddles, a new McDonald's breakfast. So it's maple syrup infused. It's sweet, then it's savoury. Because the sausage, you know, and the cheese and the egg. Oh, it's got the golden arches stamped on it too. Make that make sense. It's hard to put into words, but... Until 11 a.m, subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery orders while stocks last.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Right, this is Times Radio. It's Asma Mir sitting in for Jane and Fee. It is 2:23. We're going to keep our eye, of course, on any other developments to do with Kanye West and the Wireless Festival, which has been cancelled. But we're going to talk about, a kind of extreme marathon running, really. Runners are currently trekking through the Sahara Desert as part of the Marathon des Sables, which is often described as the toughest foot race on Earth at roughly 250 kilometres. It's taking this place in Morocco, and for 6 days, those taking part will battle scorching heat, shifting sands, and sheer exhaustion. And I've always wanted to know, why do people willingly put themselves through something so extreme? Let's find out from the ultra endurance athlete Sophie Power, who completed the race back in 2010. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
Be very, very honest. Take me back to 2010. In fact, not 2010. Take me back to the time, the year when you suddenly thought, yes, I am going to do it. Why?
Mine's an unusual story. So I wasn't a runner at all when I signed up for the race. I was second last in the mile at school. I now run for Great Britain over 24 hours, but I was second last in the mile at school, and I'd been made redundant from a job in finance. And I was just really lost. And my friend had just completed the race and said, you should do this. You know, it's an incredible thing to do. You can find yourself, you get this inner strength back in your life that you need. And he said, you can do it. And I said, but I'm not a runner, because everyone walks. So I just trusted him and signed up. And I had 9 months to train. To finish it, you only have to go 3 kilometers an hour, 2 miles an hour, and you can walk that. But I realized that I didn't want to be staying outside all day in 47 degree heat. And the next day I went for my first run.
Goodness me. And so how long did it take you to train for it?
I took 9 months to train for it, which is probably one of the shortest. I think a lot of people start out as runners and they do their marathon and they look, well, what's next? But it's very much a race that anyone can complete if you plan for it properly and you're a really good walker. And you'll find after the first 100 meters, people are in sand and they think, actually, you know, it's a much better idea. You've got heavy rucksacks on because you carry everything you need by water for those 6 days, that everyone just says, do you know what, we're just going to walk. It's long days out in the desert. So many people are capable of doing this race. It's not like finishing a marathon in under 3 hours. It's much easier than that. And they have an over 90% completion rate.
And I mean, there is no such thing as a typical day on those 6 days. But can you just explain how much of the day are you moving and for how much of the day are you not moving?
So the stages are different lengths. So a short stage might be around 20 miles. There's the marathon day, which is a full marathon, but the big day is where you do almost a double marathon. And a lot of the competitors will start at 9 a.m. and they're not finished until the afternoon of the next day. So they're going all the way through the night, carrying everything. But normally you're in a very, very simple tent setup. So admin wise, it takes quite a lot of time to, you know, you've got to cook your breakfast, you've got to make a fire to heat the water to kind of look at your freeze-dried food. It's a very simple day, tend to your feet, out there all day. The quicker members of the tent kind of get back and they help the slower members of the tent to get in, to get their stuff ready. It's a team event, and it's just, that's what's so beautiful about it. It's not like a marathon where no one talks to each other. It's very much everyone getting through the event together.
What I don't understand is how do you train for it and for running kind of up and down sand dunes, and how do you actually do it on the day? What's the technique?
So I think we see these spectacular photos of sand dunes, and that's not really what you're going over 95%+ of the time. They're the amazing shots of that. You couldn't do that for the 250 kilometres. Most of the terrain is kind of a rocky path with a little bit of sand over. Often people carry trekking poles. It's very much walkable by a strong hiker that's well prepared, especially if they've done something like hot yoga or gone in a sauna, which you can prepare for the heat. And you've really thought through every part of your pack and what you're carrying, because even the slightest rub somewhere can develop into a big cut over 6 days. And that's a pain that you're carrying through. So if you can be really good at logistics, really well prepared, choose great kit, I do believe that most strong hikers can finish this race.
Is it expensive, all the whole process? Yes. Yeah. How can you give us a rough idea of how much it might be?
I think the race entry now is around kind of £4,000 with everything there. Gosh. But this is the iconic original race. And what's happened is around the world, other races like this have sprung up. And you can do a stage race like this in beautiful places like Bhutan, Cambodia, Nepal, Iceland, with different companies that are much cheaper than the Marathon des Sables. That's the kind of the epic, the kind of the I'm going to say luxury, because it's definitely not, but there are so many opportunities, and it's a great way to see a country in a way that you normally wouldn't.
Do you keep an eye on it still? I mean, I know you completed it back in 2010, so all these years later, is it something that you still kind of watch and see who's done what?
I think you do see who wins it. For me, it's a lot on getting messages from people who've kind of signed up for it, that follow me. I just wrote a book, The Power Within, and one chapter is about the Marathon des Sables, and hearing from people who've read that and been inspired to take part in it, or their feedback, especially mums who are going back after kind of having their children. So you look at what's happening, you have lots of friends. It's still very iconic, but the best ultra runners in the world are probably not on that start line. They're probably on the UTMB start line or kind of the more competitive races. It's very much a completion race, apart from for a very small amount of people.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. Any quick advice for anyone who might be thinking, might have their eye on next year?
I would not overpack your food. You can't carry as much food as you really need. So keep an eye on your pack, make it as light as possible. That makes it as easy and as comfortable as possible. And for runners, so many runners get found out on the start line because they've never practiced walking. And you're going to be walking most of the time, no matter what level you are. So practice hiking, put on a rucksack, off to the Lake District, go on some beautiful hikes, and you'll be perfectly prepared for that start line.
Okay. That's some great advice. And you very, very much painted a picture of it. I didn't quite realise that it was as you describe. But thank you so much for that, Sophie. It's Sophie Power, British ultramarathon runner, talking about the Marathon des Sables, which I've never really understood. I honestly did think that you ran most of the way and there was a lot of sand dunes, but it doesn't seem to be quite that. But really interesting nevertheless. Thank you so much for that. There's quite a lot of you getting in touch just very quickly, and I'm not surprised at all because of the breaking news that the Wireless Festival in London has been cancelled because the main act, the headline act, Kanye West, is not allowed in the country. Lots of you getting in touch. Mike says, well done, the cancel culture mob have killed the joy again. That's a minority view. Most of you say that this is the right thing to do. And Carolyn, I haven't got the time to read all of this, but hopefully I get the gist. The debate about Kanye West headlining Wireless not only normalises anti-Semitism, but it also does something far more sinister. As usual, it has only ever become an issue because the Jewish community has flagged it. With any other community, creed and colour, things would never have got this far. Either a habitual hate preacher such as Kanye West would never have even been considered as a participant in the first place, or he would have been banned much earlier. End of story. Let me know what you think. 87222, start your message with the word Times. And we will be talking about this, of course, with Bipolar UK, actually, which is the condition that Kanye West claims to be suffering from. We'll be doing that after the news. We'll get that now with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Kanye West has been blocked from travelling to the UK to perform at the Wireless Festival in London. Within the last few minutes, organisers have also said that event has now been cancelled, with refunds being issued. The rapper made an application to travel to the country via an electronic travel authorisation, but the Home Office stopped him on the grounds his presence in the UK would not be conducive to the public good. The planned appearance revoked calls for him to be banned because of behaviour, which has included releasing a song called Heil Hitler and advertising a swastika swastika t-shirt for sale on his website. Maxwell Marlowe, Director of Public Affairs at the Adam Smith Institute, told Times Radio he doesn't think it's the government's place to tell festivals who they can book.
I think there's been a lot of contrition on his behalf. The other thing is he's just done a sell-out performance in California, you know, of all places, you know, like a liberal fountainhead of America, sold out. I'm pretty sure everyone who went there weren't raging anti-Semites. And, you know, we've just published a freedom of speech bill. This is a freedom of speech issue, I think, fundamentally. And unless there is qualifying evidence that he was going to be a threat to the Public Order Act, specifically Section 4, then I don't think he should have been refused a visa. And I'd like to see the evidence from the Home Secretary, fundamentally.
Donald Trump has written in a social media post the words, "A whole civilization will die tonight," as a 1 a.m. deadline on Iran draws nearer for a major shipping route to be reopened. The US president goes on to allege regime change in Tehran, which analysts dispute. An ex-Facebook engineer in London is on police bail, accused of downloading 30,000 private pictures. There are also allegations he designed a program to avoid internal checks before his sacking. England's resident, formerly junior doctors, are on strike. It's day one of six in their pay row, although the health secretary has called them the standout winners of the entire public sector. And Iceland has offered a job to a Waitrose worker who says he was sacked for confronting an Easter egg thief. Walker Smith was dismissed after 17 years for breaking rules. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio. Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Right now, a guide dog puppy is taking her very first steps. One day, she'll help someone with sight loss live a full and independent life.
Find the crossing, Bess. Good girl.
When you sponsor a puppy with guide dogs, you're there for it all. Her wobbly walks, her first harness, the life-changing partnership. It's more than a donation. It's the start of a life-changing story. Search Sponsor a Guide Dog Puppy and be part of a story you'll be proud to share.
Guide Dogs. Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
And this is Times Radio with Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. I'm here till 4 o'clock. And then John Pienaar will be here with Times Radio Drive. You've seen a lot, you've read a lot, you've reacted to a lot. But yes. What do you make then of Donald Trump's post today?
Well, the post is gobsmacking in itself. I mean, to have the President of the United States, historically, who wears the mantle, the unofficial title of leader of the free world, to talk about the destruction of an entire civilization irretrievably. I mean, later on, of course, we're going to be talking about the main point overarching all of this, which is it possible that President Trump might actually destroy the every power plant and every bridge in Iran? That would be an historic act of destruction and historic acts of economic disruption of a kind that we simply could not foresee where this is going to go. It would be on that sort of scale. And then we have that language in the Truth Social post about the destruction of a whole civilization. He said he doesn't want it to happen, but it probably will. I mean, that language is the dictionary definition of barbaric.
It's the casual barbarism of it, isn't it? I don't want it to happen, but it might. Well, I mean, kind of shrugging.
You'd imagine, in as far as a leader of a modern democratic state could contemplate destruction on that scale, it is that fact that is in contemplation is remarkable. To describe it in that way takes it into a different kind of dimension. In the end, it's the reality of what happens that counts, if it does happen, because you can never rule out the possibility there will be another reprieve, you know, at some point in the next few hours. It has happened three times so far, in which case it might be argued this is about scaring the hardliners among the hardliners in Tehran into capitulating on Donald Trump's terms or something close enough to them to bring about a ceasefire. But that does also go against the pretty much a waste of opinion among experts that the hardliners in Tehran, they're willing to sustain damage of almost any kind and loss of life on almost any scale before giving up power in Tehran, in which case there's a misunderstanding of what this war in Tehran is really all about. So we're watching all of that, talking about all of that. I've got a former high-ranking US general, that is General Ben Hodges, to give us his thoughts on all of that, including, of course, the argument that an attack of that kind would be a clear breach of international law. It would be a war crime under the Geneva Convention. I'm talking to Aaron David Miller, who's a former Middle East negotiator for the US State Department, and one of the best experts and commentators you're ever going to find. So we're going through that story, just as you would imagine. I'm talking about, of course, the Kanye West story, which is going to get an awful lot of attention today, just getting some takes on what went on here and why and how did it happen.
Yeah.
And some other stories too, Asma. The Vice President of the United States is in Budapest and talking about helping the hardline Orban government, which just tears up any principle of not interfering in foreign elections. We know that this sort of thing is on the American agenda, but there they are. It's happening. So we're talking about that story today and many other things too. A former Israeli government spokesman, Elon Levy, is going to be with me. And I don't know if you've seen, I'm sure you have, Richard Spencer's piece on the front pages of the Times about the settlers in Israel who, under the cover, if that's the word, of the war in Iran, are killing and burning, as Richard Spencer argues, with impunity. So we'll get the thoughts of a defender of the Israeli government on the programme.
That will be very interesting. Thank you very much for that, John. That's John Pienaar. He is here on Times Radio with Drive at 4 o'clock, straight after this programme. Right, we do need to talk about Kanye West and the Wireless Festival, because it's been cancelled after the headliner, Kanye West, was blocked from entering the UK. The Home Office cancelled his entry permit on the grounds that his presence would not be conducive to the public good. It follows years of anti-Semitic and racist remarks from the artist, including music and merchandise referencing Nazi ideology. West's booking sparked a substantial backlash across politics and the UK's Jewish community. Sponsors, including Pepsi, had also pulled out. Let's speak to Michael Kill, who's chief executive of the Nighttime Industries Association. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
This is a bit of a mess, isn't it? I mean, what were the organisers, do you think, of Wireless Festival thinking?
Well, it's a challenging one, as you can appreciate. I mean, what people don't understand is it's quite fraught out there, particularly getting hold of headliners, etc., for major festivals. But I don't think this is really about just one artist. It's really about what the music industry stands for right now. That sort of cancellation of Wireless decision to issue refunds also shows that vulnerability and also that government intervention over Kanye West. We saw it with Tyler, the Creator. And more and more, what we're seeing is this growing intersection between culture, politics and public accountability. Tyler, the Creator, at the time, Theresa May put that ban in and blocked it, was sort of engaged there as well. But the concern is one, the vulnerability of festivals out there, which we know is inherently a position, particularly for some of the bigger companies. But as you can appreciate, this has come off the back of an intervention from government. So it's really concerning. And there are two forms of thought here. One, the government intervention in entertainment and our industry. But the other side of things is obviously the impact that Kanye West would have coming into the country.
Do you think the government should have intervened?
I think one of the challenges that you have out there is we've got to really assess where the sort of government sits in this. So there are a lot of people out there saying that they shouldn't have intervened, but there are a lot of people out there saying that there should have been a more considered approach to bringing someone like Kanye West in, particularly given some of his political views and the anti-Semitic sort of position that he's undertaken, not only in his songs, but also in his merch. So I think there are very much some quite fused, but that really does show that there is this real considered divide. And what we are as an industry is something that brings communities together. So the concern I understand from a government perspective is this would create further divide. But in the same respect, there is a concern that that intervention will happen more readily as it has done with things like Bob Vallance and the likes of Kneecap, etc., because our industry of music is becoming more politicised in the grander scheme of things.
So, I mean, it sounds a bit like you would perhaps prefer, Michael, for these things not to get to the stage where the government has to intervene. But how could this, do you think, have been handled differently before all of that?
I think we talk about it. I mean, there are obviously secondary actions. There's a lot of talk about Kanye West coming out and making a statement apologising for his actions in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, the concern is those apologies have come very late. These things happened a short time ago and those apologies didn't come then. Also, the interests of meeting with some of the Jewish communities was somewhat late after the announcement. So I think, as we do with a lot of things, that preemptive response of actually getting in and speaking to people and laying the ground of something like this happening, I think is really important. So I think either way, whether it's right or wrong that Kanye West would come and perform, I think the sentiment of a festival coming in and talking to people that would be greatly affected by this, I think is a strong approach rather than announce and then try to backtrack into understanding how people would feel. And the sentiment is quite clear. There's a lot of divide, a lot of concern. I've got a 17-year-old daughter. The first thing she said was, "Dad, you know, can I go to see Kanye West?" But she was drawn between two things. She understood the anti-Semitic side, but she understands as an amazing artist, she would like to see him. So you can see where people are drawn and how that's influenced people, particularly at a very young age. So we have to recognize the influence of some of these bigger artists on young people within our communities and across our industry.
Okay. Michael, thank you for giving that kind of point of view. We haven't really heard that. It's Michael Kill, who's Chief Executive of the Nighttime Industries Association. We are going to speak to Rosie Phillips now, who's the Deputy CEO at Bipolar UK. And the reason for that is, of course, because Kanye West apologised for his previous behaviour. As Michael just said, that was in January, and he attributed it to manic episodes linked to bipolar disorder. Good afternoon to you, Rosie.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting us on.
You're very welcome. For people who don't know, what is bipolar disorder?
So bipolar is an extreme of mood. So you will have a very low mood. It's much more intense than the average person might experience. So we have a mood scale, for example. So that goes from 0 to 10. So if you're in 0 to 3, you could be exceptionally depressed. You may be even at risk of taking your own life, for example, because we know it increases the risk of suicide by 20 times. If you're on a sort of 7, 8, 9, going into 10, you could be into the mania, hypermania, but mania and delusions. And that means that you could be at risk of self-harm again through risky behaviours. You could also be at risk of getting sectioned through the Mental Health Act. So those type of things really disruptive for people's lives. People's relationships are impacted. People's careers are impacted. Mm. And episodes can last for short periods or long periods. And in between that, people can have good periods of stability. So
right.
I just want to say it's something you can live well with the right support and treatment.
Okay. And I'm not asking you to give a diagnosis here. I don't even know if Kanye West has had an official diagnosis. He may have done. But do you think that his attributing his behaviour to bipolar disorder doesn't justify, but explains some of the stuff he's done?
I think what we have to remember is saying that you have a kind of condition like bipolar as an explanation for behaviours isn't really helpful, and it kind of is misleading and actually trivialises quite a lot, which is a really significant mental health condition. And it oversimplifies it because the nuances that go with bipolar are quite more severe, and people's sort of experiencing from kind of like their ability to manage a job or just ability to have a relationship. And some people live with those symptoms for years without a diagnosis, and it, you know, it does devastate lives. And I think that is kind of what the message is that I'd like to get over, is with the right support and treatment, you can live well with it. We can't obviously comment on individual cases, and this has been bubbling for a number of years with his kind of attributing some of the behaviour to bipolar. And I think you have to step away from kind of separating sometimes what is behaviour or poor behaviour and what is bipolar. And I think it does oversimplify it to some degree.
Yeah, I'm trying to cast my mind back to his explanation. He said that he had a head injury in a car crash, I think it was, many years ago, and that he believes that contributed to him developing bipolar disorder.
And I think one of the other things that we've put a statement out previously about is whilst head injuries, can result in a mental health condition. There's no research or significant research that we could be aware of that sort of said bipolar was a result of a head injury. So, again, I think it's something that you have to look wider into in terms of there isn't present research that demonstrates that it's likely bipolar was a result, and treat it with caution. I think that's what I'd say.
Just finally, what do news stories like this, which bring up, I mean, I'm thinking about the BAFTAs and how we all started talking about Tourette's, and now we have Kanye West, and to a degree, we're talking about bipolar disorder. Does that help or hinder?
I think it can help raise awareness, definitely. I think as an organisation, we would always want to get over a message about we're here to support anyone affected with mood swings, mood disorder. They might not think they have it yet, but their symptoms maybe are starting to show. Well, they're worried about symptoms. Maybe they perceive the diagnosis, and we're here for everyone that is requiring support or more information, and family and friends included. So I think it's really important that's part of the message that this kind of media awareness can help get across. We've also got a great campaign at the moment, Could It Be Bipolar? Maybe it's bipolar, and that's something that, again, if you're worried about symptoms, you could go and tap into our website and take a mood disorder questionnaire, and that could help you then take the information from that along to a visit to your GP to check in with your healthcare professional to get that sort of journey through the pathway to getting a diagnosis if your symptoms are severe. And get over things like low mood as well as high mood, because bipolar will have both. It's not just about depression. It's not just about mania. It's a bit of a roller coaster in terms of how the symptoms are experienced in the main. And that's something that's very difficult I live with bipolar, so I know how difficult it can be to manage those extremes. So I'd encourage anyone to reach out to our charity and get the support they need.
Okay, Rosie, thank you very much for that. It's very reassuring. It's Rosie Phillips, who is the Deputy CEO at Bipolar UK. We're talking about that, of course, because of Kanye West, who's been blocked from coming to the UK for the Wireless Festival, and the Wireless Festival itself has now been cancelled. Right, coming up, what disruption will the latest bout of resident doctors' strikes bring? It is 2:50.
Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. Join Hugo every Monday to Thursday morning from 10 as he takes a sometimes serious and sometimes satirical look at the day's news, politics and culture, covering all the major stories making the headlines with in-depth analysis and exclusive interviews. Hugo Rifkind on Times Radio with Elevon. We support all payments for your business. Make one decision today. Visit elevon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
It is at 2:52. Now, resident doctors have begun their six-day strike in England today over pay. It marks 60 days of strike action carried out by them in 3 years. The NHS reports that doctor strikes have cost hospitals more than £3 billion so far. Let's speak to Dr. Rachel Ward, who is a GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. She joins us now to discuss the top health stories. Good afternoon to you, Rachel.
Good afternoon, Asma.
This has been going on then for 3 years now. We know what the arguments are, but is there any kind of, I don't know, what's the kind of level of support do you think amongst the rest of the NHS actually when it comes to resident doctors and their specific strike?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I would say that through that 3 years, it's varied quite a lot. And actually, I remember there being a real turnaround a few months ago when there was kind of talk of these, you know, new jobs appearing for trainees. And then actually quite quickly in the NHS, word was kind of spreading as to really how it was not as it appeared. What I would say is training doctors, training the NHS, it's a very complex process. There's a lot of criteria which people have to meet. And of course, we don't expect the general public to know the ins and outs of it. For example, what was construed as these new jobs appearing very quickly appeared when you looked into the details that they weren't really proper training jobs, for example, and the details of which most people wouldn't have understood from the headlines. So I would actually say at the moment that the support for junior doctors within the NHS is pretty strong. I'm a long way off being a junior doctor. I've been qualified now for over 10 years. Mm. But what I would say is, you know, I have trainees in my practice and I see them coming through. I see them having huge amounts of debt, you know, £100,000 worth of debt when they graduate. I see them really struggling to get training jobs. I see them in a situation where they're having to accept to live anywhere in the UK, being separated from partners, not being able to just settle down and do normal things in life, and have huge expense to have that privilege. So actually, I think at the moment, you know, we see on the inside the challenges that junior doctors have, and we support that, you know, something has to change. And I feel that there's lots of areas that could be improved.
Oh, very briefly, what are they?
Well, as I said, you know, they've got massive issues with huge amounts of debt. They pay from their salary, which does not start off high. They're paying huge amounts on insurance, training courses, examinations, membership for Royal Colleges. You know, there's a lot that you could address there, in my mind, fairly quickly.
OK, we're going to move on and talk about contraception and pain relief. Women being put off having contraception fitted due to inadequate pain relief, which could be leading to a rise in unplanned pregnancies and abortions. So explain what we mean about contraception being fitted.
Yeah, so this story particularly focuses on coils. So, you know, we have lots of different coils. We have copper coils, which are an older form, and we also have drug-eluting coils. So we have coils which have progesterone in them, and they're different properties, but essentially they are used for a form of contraception which sits inside the womb anywhere between kind of 3 and 10 years. There is a feeling that, you know, like other forms of contraception, people are not coming forward to have coils fitted. One of the reasons being that there is a lot more coverage about negative experiences of them being fitted. Mm. Now, I think, you know, when it comes to contraception, I think there is a lot of incorrect information on social media, for example. However, I think this is a really interesting story that we need as a medical profession to really be more introspective about the idea of having a coil fitted. And so the Royal College of Reproductive Healthcare is really now urging us to, it's a real campaign talking about better pain relief, making the experience much more manageable and less unpleasant for people.
Just briefly, what kind of pain relief are we talking about? What's on offer? What do women get offered?
So at the moment, a standard would be really having, over-the-counter oral medication. So that would be paracetamol, ibuprofen, maybe some codeine if you wanted to. But there are other forms of pain relief, such as, you know, local anaesthetic forms that you would put on the cervix. That is not a routine process at the moment. It obviously makes the procedure much more complex. Mm. But we as a medical professional are being encouraged to really offer and consider this as a more routine option.
OK, finally, today's forecast, apparently highs of 24 degrees in some areas. And with that, you know, some people love that. But bad news for hay fever sufferers. The Met Office has issued a week-long red alert. What can people who suffer from hay fever, is there anything they can do to keep it at bay?
Yes. So I think the first thing that I would say, so we see this every year where we kind of think, gosh, we, you know, hay fever season is here. First bit of advice is have a good read the NHS website, because it gives very detailed advice about treatments, but also things that you can do to reduce your pollen exposure. Now, the most common thing that I see with people coming forward with issues with hay fever is inconsistency or inadequate treatment. So you need to tackle it from all angles. So that is a baseline antihistamine medication. Go for a non-sedating one. You can get them very cheaply at kind of supermarket brands. That's your baseline. And then you need to be using eye drops, and you need to be using nasal spray. So you're attacking all of those areas for your upper respiratory tract that get affected. Now, when people come forward, I have to say it's quite uncommon that they are consistently doing all three things
right,
and still having significant symptoms. So you've got to keep going with it. Now is the start of the season. It's tree pollen season now. We'll come into kind of grass season, which some people are worse in. But, you know, take the advice, get the over-the-counter medications and be consistent.
Okay, great advice. Rachel, thank you very much. That
thank
is
you.
Dr. Rachel Ward, who is a GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Rachel was saying there that amongst other NHS workers, support for resident doctors and their strikes is still quite high, according to her. I don't think it's that high amongst the general public, not as high as it is amongst the NHS. Obviously, Chris says, I don't think there's a huge amount of support for junior doctors, resident doctors. They have great pensions and T's and C's as well as good pay. Andy cries a river. For the poor doctors, maybe don't go to medical school if you do not like the salary. And there's lots of you still getting in touch about Kanye West, of course, and the Wireless Festival, which has been cancelled because Kanye West is no longer coming to the UK. The Home Office have said that him coming to the UK would not be conducive to the public good. What do you think about that? 0333 00323353, that is the WhatsApp number, or you can text 87222. Start your message with the word Times.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the Times.
Good afternoon. It is 3 o'clock. You're listening to Asma Mir on Times Radio. Still to come, self-swab kits are meant to give survivors of rape or assault a way to save evidence. So why are the police saying they shouldn't be used? We'll talk to an organisation that makes them and an MP who wants them banned. We'll have sport too. English rugby's former captain Courtney Laws is unretiring, so could he be the salvation of the team? And why could a few, okay, a lot of Deliveroos cost a French footballer more than 5 million euros? Plus, my big interview after 3:30 is with fitness coach Elizabeth Davis. We'll discuss how to get stronger as you age and her book, Training for Your Old Lady Body. First, the latest news, Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Wireless Festival has been cancelled after US rapper Kanye West was blocked from entering the UK. Music fans who've bought tickets for the July event will now be refunded. The rapper had offered to meet Jewish leaders, having apologised for anti-Semitic remarks. Carl Turner, Labour MP, says at the heart of this, it wasn't a complicated issue.
It was a little bit indecisive, because what the Prime Minister could have done is come out and say, this man will not be permitted to enter the UK. He is the Prime Minister and he has the authority to refuse that visitor visa, or indeed the Home Secretary does. And I'm sure the Prime Minister could have spoken with Shabana Mahmood and said, we don't want this anti-Semite here in this country, and we don't care whether he's been booked to perform at a particular festival. End of subject.
Donald Trump has referred to his Iran deadline, writing, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. The US president added, maybe something revolutionary wonderful can happen. He threatened a tax on Iran's infrastructure unless a major shipping channel reopens, leading Israel to warn Iranians to avoid trains. Malcolm Nance is a former US Navy intelligence officer.
We could put a nuclear weapon into any city in Iran in 23 minutes. And what will change is every nation in that part of the world will shun us forever. This is Donald Trump using what I really suspect is mental illness as foreign policy.
Dame Antonia Romeo will become the first cabinet secretary in a decade to publish her personal objectives. She took on her role as the head of the civil service in February, and this afternoon will set out how she sees that job, along with being Sir Keir Starmer's principal policy advisor and an aim of rewriting the civil service code. The move will be seen as an expansion of Romeo's authority amid reports Darren Jones, who was brought into Number 10 last September, was spending less time in Downing Street. The government's announced interest rates on Plan 2 and 3 student loans will be capped at 6% from September. It's after criticism of the student loan system, with many graduates seeing their debts grow to more than they borrowed. The supermarket chain Iceland has offered a sacked Waitrose worker a job who claims he was let go for tackling an Easter egg thief. Walker Smith had been with the company for 17 years, but the firm claims he'd broken rules designed to protect staff from a serious danger to life, following a confrontation in Clapham in South London. And the top temperature of the year so far of 22.9 degrees Celsius has been set in Wales. England and Northern Ireland have seen highs too, and Scotland will likely have joined them by the end of the day. Forecasters say tomorrow will be warmer for most before things cool down again from Thursday. For a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio for Jane and Fee until four this afternoon. Coming up, how useful or legally admissible is a self-swabbing DNA kit for rape survivors? We're going to speak to the company who's selling the kits to students and to an MP who says they are not helpful. We're going to round up all the day's sport with Hugo Chambray. And if you're a woman in midlife or approaching midlife and you're confused by all the messages on social media about lifting weights, make sure that you listen out for Elizabeth Davis, who is a lawyer turned personal trainer who's training women, and I quote, for their old lady body. And that's after 3:30. You know how to get in touch, 0333 003 2353. That's a WhatsApp number, or you can always text 87222. There's a lot of you getting in touch about resident doctors. Many of you who have perhaps resident doctors in your family, and I will read some of them out in a moment. I also want to read out Keir Starmer's tweet. This follows the blocking of Kanye West from coming to the UK and the subsequent cancellation, the entire cancellation of the Wireless Festival. He has said that Kanye West should never have been invited to headline Wireless. This government stands firmly with the Jewish community, and we will not stop in our fight to confront and defeat the poison of anti-Semitism. We will always take the action necessary to protect the public and uphold our values. So that's Keir Starmer tweeting in the last 10 minutes or so. And you're still getting in touch about that as well, which you can continue to do. Right, just a quick warning here that the next story will contain some discussion of sexual assault. Could a simple swab help to end rape? An organisation called Enough says that it could, and it's handed out thousands of its self-swab rape kits across the UK since its launch in 2024. Now, they look a bit like at-home COVID tests, and Enough describes them as the breathalyzer of rape, giving survivors who aren't ready to go to the police the power to collect DNA from their attacker. But some experts are concerned about whether or not the kits could actually be used as evidence, and that they could put people off seeking essential medical and well-being support. We're going to speak to two people about this. Katie White, who is a co-founder of Enough. Good afternoon to you, Katie. Katie, are you there? Okay, you might be on mute. We're going to ask you to unmute.
Yeah,
hi,
sorry.
Hi, Katie. Don't worry. We've all done it. And Alicia Kearns, the Conservative MP and Shadow Minister for Safeguarding. Good afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
Katie, can you just explain this product? What does it actually do? How is it used? And how would it actually help survivors of assault or rape?
Yeah, thank you for having me on today and for having this discussion. So Enough is a non-profit that is set up to try and prevent the rape crisis that exists, both for university students, but also across the UK. It was close to 500,000 people who were raped last year. Very little deterrence exists at the moment, as less than 1% of rapists are convicted. If you speak to survivors, 80% of them aren't reporting, but they want to be able to do something. And as with any crime, if you can create a system where most people feel comfortable coming forwards, that prevents the perpetrators doing it in the first place. So the reason that we have developed the whole reporting solution via Enough, which includes a self-testing kit, but also includes writing down an anonymous testimony, is so that there is an overwhelming movement of people coming forward, and that creates accountability for perpetrators. So the very presence of the kit, and I've got one here to show you, looks like this. By giving these out in the thousands across university campuses, completely for free, I think you mentioned at the start we're selling, so I just want to make clear, completely for free, this sends a very clear signal. If you do not get consent, there are consequences. Not only does it create that direct threat, but it also creates a cultural change whereby groups of students, including young men, sports teams, for example, the rugby team at Cambridge University 2 weeks ago, takes these, puts it on their table in their university house, and that starts a conversation about consent that they were never having otherwise.
Okay.
And so the combination of those things, 70% of students in Bristol, our first pilot university, said that they thought Enough as a campaign, as a social movement, the kit being one part of that, prevented rape at their university.
Okay, so a couple of things there. Let's clarify a couple of things. So yes, you do hand out the rape kits to students for free, but you do also sell them online for £20. Is that correct?
Yes, 99% of the kits have been given out for free. The only reason they're available online to buy is to ensure access for people in other places. We sell them for less than the cost of even doing the laboratory test. None of this is about making money. It's about ensuring access.
Okay. And the 70%, I mean, how many students were asked? 70% of what kind of number?
This was done via student societies. So sports teams would put out the survey to their teams, and it was hundreds of students that responded to this. So it was independently done. It wasn't done via ourselves asking people.
Okay. You will know that there are some people who think that this, while this comes from a good place, it might not actually be evidentially reliable because it's not done in a kind of clinical environment necessarily. There's a risk of contamination. There's increased likelihood that evidence collected might not be admissible in court. I mean, this comes from people like the Victims Commissioner and Rape Crisis England and Wales. They're just worried about the admissibility of this evidence.
Yes, this was a huge concern to us before we launched and was a key thing that we factored into the development of it. And we wouldn't have launched if there were any concerns on any of those levels. We have to start from a place of people not reporting today and not getting any way really of being able to create justice for themselves now or in the future. Kits can be admissible. Tampons could be admissible. Underwear can be admissible. They have previously convicted rapists, and many experts are aware of that. We completely agree that the best quality evidence is from the police or from the SARC. But if 80% plus of survivors are not getting that, then for them, it is far better to have a less high quality version, but something which can still stand up in court, particularly when we think about serial rapists.
Okay.
And so from the perspective of existing experts within the sector, we welcome all of their opinions and we want to meet with all of them, and we have met with some of them so far. But what we should all be recognising is the system doesn't work for survivors today. We should create systems of reporting that work for them, and we should be working together to make them safer rather than telling survivors those options shouldn't exist.
Okay.
Because one thing is clear, the system today isn't working and survivors are asking for something different.
Right. I just want to clarify just a word you used. You said SARC, that's a Sexual Assault Referral Centre. Alicia Kearns, do you think that there is a place for this at all?
Well, I'm afraid I don't think there's a place for them, and it's because they cannot be admissible in court. Look, it sounds lovely, but the entire messaging from Enough is that a swab rape kit will deter rapists. First of all, it is offensive, the concept that it is my duty to deter a rapist. It is not. But secondly, the idea that having a self-swab rape kit at home is somehow going to stop them from raping you, I'm afraid is just not true. And the reality is what Katie is doing, whether it's well-meaning or not, is taking people away from the police, away from those sexual assault clinics who should be supporting them, when we all know that in court, it isn't a semen sample that proves that you've been raped. It's the evidence, I'm afraid, of the scratches, of his DNA under your skin, under your nails. It's things like that that prove it. And if you do not have those, then you cannot often get the conviction. And this isn't just my concerns. Over 40 charities have spoken out saying these rape kits aren't admissible. The National Police Chief Council said it. Somerset and Avon Police have said that they're really concerned. Let me read it. Self-swabbing kits introduce evidential challenges during any criminal prosecution. And we've also had a child who was raped's case collapse because they used a self-swab rape kit. And some of these kits are going missing in the post. I'm really sorry. I get the idea that we want to support women, but even the statistics that Katie used there, where she said that 500,000 women are raped, that is not true. 0.5% of the UK population were victims of rape last year. That's about 150,000. Even if you extrapolated that many don't report, it doesn't take that number. And I'm afraid this is one of the consistent problems with Enough. Mm. The statistics don't add
she was right about the conviction.
Can I come back on some of those things?
Of course you can. Just hang on a second. She was right about the conviction rate, though, wasn't she? It's very low.
Oh, the conviction rate is low, but we shouldn't be weaponising that to say to women, don't go to the police. There is a third way. Don't go to sexual assault clinics. There's a third way. There is no third way. You go to the police, you go to the experts who can swab you, you make sure they get a swab that is done in a clinically sound way, where there is proof where the sample came from, how it was collected, that the evidential basis... Everyone's watched CSI. Okay. They know how important it is that you have that chain of evidence. And most of all, they can give you that support that you need to recover from the rape that you've been through.
Okay, let's go. Let's go to Katie now, because you made quite a few assertions there, and it's only fair that she can answer some of them. Katie.
Thank you. And also, I'd just like to say it's nice to speak to you finally, Alicia, because I have been trying to meet with you to discuss some of these things for a while, because I totally respect where you're coming from and your opinions, but a lot of it is based on misconceptions. So the first, I'll just go through some of the things you said. The first one about it being the individual survivor's duty to prevent this, completely false. The whole reason we're doing this
you
is about creating...
That.
No, okay, please let me speak.
Alicia, just let her go through all the... and I'll come back to you.
Thank you. The whole thing here is that it is creating a societal deterrent. So it's not about having one in your bedroom and whipping it out. It's about it being present and available on university campuses, everyone knowing and talking about it. It can be admissible. That has been confirmed by leading KC barristers. The people that have opinions on admissibility are people who are not authorities in admissibility. Their concerns are that it won't be as admissible as if you got the high quality forensic police examination. But very, very few people want to put themselves through that 3 to 4 hour invasive, traumatizing process. We do not discourage anyone from going and doing that. We do the exact opposite. By calling ourselves option three, by speaking to students at our pop-ups, and you're very welcome to come along to one of these and see, you will see that every single person, we say option one is police, option two is SARC. Most people don't know what a SARC is, so we actually educate them on that. And so in a way, Enough is actually the first stepping stone for people to accept that there are ways of reporting that they might not have even known about, Enough being the bottom of that list. When you talk about the thing that matters in court cases being scratches, 85% of survivors are raped by someone they know. There is no scratch. It's within a relationship. It's someone you know. When you talk about the child and kit going missing, no case has fallen apart because of a self-testing kit. The police have both put out guidance saying that they're not as forensically detailed as the police, and therefore police should come first. But the police have also instructed every single police force in the UK to use self-testing kits with the same evidential integrity as any other exhibit, because they know that that can contribute to a valuable court case. Most people today have nothing. They only have their word. The rate of rape, we reached that number through ONS data and also extrapolating it by the number who don't report, because we all know that so few people come forward. I think we can all agree, though, that any more than one rape is too much. So we shouldn't be arguing about that. So, yeah, those are just the few things I wanted to get across.
Okay,
and Alicia, I really would like to meet with you further to talk through this. We haven't had a chance to do that, and I highly value your opinion.
Alicia, would you be up for that?
I'm afraid I'm not, and the reason is I've seen the letters that Katie has sent threatening legal action to rape charities across our country and to young girls at Bristol University and others who have said that they don't support these kits and who've raised questions. So anyone who raises their voice, and I'm doing it because I know as an MP I have more protection, so I have a duty to use my voice, receive letters saying their future employment will be reduced, that they need to immediately take down anything they've said, take down social media posts, and these are rape charities as well, not just young girls. So no, I've got no interest, I'm afraid. Katie, I'm going to continue now. You've said that the point that you believe the police have been instructed to use them. Guidance for police comes to the National Police Chiefs Council, who have said self-testing DNA kits cause significant issues around the integrity and admissibility of criminal evidence as it moves the criminal justice process. We urge caution regarding claims made about the evidential value and deterrent effect of self-swab kits. The police chief council, who you claim have instructed police have done it, last week came out with a statement where the National Police Chiefs Council told police not to use self-swab rape kits. When you say you have leading evidential experts who say this is valid, I'm sorry, but the police outweigh anyone that you can't physically name and give a name to, as well as the over 40 charities. My job is to make sure that when women are raped, they go into the system where they can get the support they need and get the protection so they get prosecutions. You are taking DNA out of the system, so serial rapists are not being reported, they're not being recognised, and they're definitely not being tackled.
Okay, Alicia, I do need to go back to Katie.
Apologies.
Now. It's all right. There's a lot in this. Katie, first of all, some of the allegations at the beginning of that, are they true?
No, they are not true. We have been in many difficult situations with people misrepresenting enough. We've always asked people to have a conversation with us. For example, yourself, Alicia, we emailed you and said, you know, you're saying things about us that aren't true. Please, can we meet? And you haven't replied and you've refused to do so. But we're having this conversation now, which is good. And that's a step forward. When you talk about... it's gone from my head now. The National Police Chiefs Council. Yeah, there are two documents, and this is really, really important. There is the public document, which is the position statement that you've just read from, which effectively says everyone should go to the police first if they want to. That we all agree, first step. There is also, and I'm very happy to send this after you, guidance that the National Police Chief Council have given to all police forces saying how they should use a self-testing kit if one is presented to them. Because it's all very well saying everyone should go to the police, but what if people want to use a self-testing kit? And it's no one's place to ever tell a survivor who would otherwise do nothing that they shouldn't use something which will help them preserve DNA. And that guidance is to use self-testing DNA kits with the same evidential integrity as any other exhibit. And that's because anything can be valuable to a case, even if it is not okay. The police.
I think when it comes to admissibility and evidence, I think both of you are not going to agree. So we'll have to leave it there. But I really hope that, you know, people who are listening at home will be able to make up their own minds about this. They've heard both arguments and they can make up their own minds. Thank you very much to both of you. I hope you feel that you got adequate time. Katie White, who is co-founder of Enough, and Alicia Cairns, who is the Shadow Safeguarding Minister. And I know it was a pretty horrendous subject. Of course, I'm talking about sexual assault and rape. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised, you could send us an email at feedback@times.radio. feedback@times.radio, and we will point you in the direction of the resources that you need. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio. Coming up, why could a few Deliveroo orders cost one footballer more than 5 million euros? It's 3:20.
Times Radio Breakfast.
Tune in to Times Radio Breakfast from 6 a.m. with Rosie Wright and Callum McDonald in for Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Thank you for having us. We're going to bring you the very latest as President Trump's deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz passes. We'll get views and analysis from around the world.
And we'll talk through the day's news with the former Conservative Minister Edwina Curry and with the New Statesman's Will Lloyd.
Times Radio Breakfast.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
If you want your brand to stand alongside trusted journalism and be seen as credible and established, then visibility alone isn't enough. When it comes to advertising, are you simply staying visible or truly being heard? At the Times Radio advertising event, you'll receive a custom campaign for your business, event-only prices and free creative built to elevate your profile. May the 11th to the 15th. Register now at newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. Stop staying quiet. Start being heard.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio. Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Now, I wonder if you knew that if you have a Times Digital subscription, you can actually share it with up to three people at no extra cost. It means that friends or family members can get their own Times subscription, complete with login details, newsletter subscriptions and their own preferences. To get started, just go to your online account, and if you've got bonus accounts enabled, just follow the instructions to add people. If you don't currently have bonus accounts as part of your package, it's easy to contact customer services to upgrade. Now, this is Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover all this week. Coming up after 3:30, we have Elizabeth Davis, known on Instagram as This Woman Lifts. She's going to be here to share why she is weight training for her older self, and perhaps you should too. And every week on the show, you will hear fantastic interviews, brilliant guests. And if you miss it, you don't have to worry, because you can listen to it on Jane and Fee's hit podcast, Off Air. You can hear all of their 3:30 interviews in full, including Nancy Birtwistle, Carol Vorderman, David Baddiel and Jenny Godfrey. Now, recently they spoke to the best-selling author William Boyd about his espionage Gabriel Dax series. He told them the books have been optioned and a script has been commissioned, and Jane asked him who he'd want to play Gabriel.
I'm probably putting a terrible hex on the whole process, but the person I'd really like to play Gabriel Dax is a young English actor called Josh O'Connor.
Oh, I know. Oh, yes.
And I think there's something about, I mean, I've been following his career. I've never
met
him. That's
a good choice.
But it's something about his look and his kind of mercurial character that I think would work very well. But, you know, that's, as I say, I probably put a curse on it. But his star is rising fast, so he may be beyond us, for all I know, by the time we get round to casting.
That was William Boyd. Of course, you can download that and many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Right, it's 3:24. Former England rugby captain Courtney Laws says he's officially unretiring and wants to play for his country at the next World Cup. The 37-year-old has signed for Sale Sharks team and says he's available for international duty if he is needed. Let's speak to the sports journalist Hugo Chambray. Hi, Hugo.
Afternoon, Asma.
How big a deal is this?
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, the unretire, yeah, isn't it? But, I mean, Courtney Laws was a fantastic player for England, a stalwart of two very successful World Cup campaigns in 2019 and 2023. He's got over 100 caps, but he's been plying his trade in the French second division for the last couple of years, while also working, I should say, as a brilliant Times columnist. And he hasn't shied away from getting stuck into the current England team in their recent dire Six Nations whilst in that role as a Times columnist. But here he says, I'm coming back to England. He said it happened as a bit of a whirlwind, and he says he knows it'll be a drastic change. But he has written in the Times today talking about coming back to Sale Sharks. And he says, well, I guess that means I'm back in the frame to play for England again. And he says he will do that, and he'll bring leadership. He still feels like his game is at a level that, you know, 37 is not old, but as professional rugby players go, it's getting onto his later years, and he clearly feels like he's still got something left to give on the international stage with the World Cup next year.
Has he said much about how easy or not it is to keep up that level of fitness at the age of 37?
He's talked about the differences in the France, in the French league, in the way rugby is played in France, because generally the players over there, even in the second division, are extremely large. They play an ambitious style of game. So he's saying almost that his physicality has improved. He's had to take on new responsibilities. He's got more strings to his bow. So it clearly feels like he will be an asset to an England team that could really, I mean, use a bit of that oomph up front, if you take the last Six Nations as evidence.
Mm. Being brutally honest here, and I know you won't want to be pessimistic, but in your honest opinion, what are England's prospects for the Rugby World Cup next year?
That's a good question. I mean, based on the last Six Nations, you would say not very good. But if you'd have been talking to me before the Six Nations, you would have said they'll be right up there. They'll want to be getting into a final with the likes of South Africa, with the likes of France, and trying to win it. So I think it's dangerous to have a recency bias in sport, because although England have some incredibly tough tests coming up, their next game is away to the two-time world champions, South Africa. Then they've got to play Fiji. They've got to go away to Argentina. So, I mean, a lot will be seen in the summer of how England bounce back after winning just one game in the Six Nations. They then went away to France and they did lose to the eventual Six Nations champions, but put in a much better showing. So I would say this England team are a little bit in the wilderness at the moment, but there's every chance in the next 18 months or so between now and the World Cup that they could prove a lot of doubters wrong. And I don't want to make a prediction that will be made to look very silly then.
I'm not going to hold you to a prediction, I promise. Let's squeeze two more in quickly. Arsenal, they've got a new drill that aims to save their season.
I mean, yeah, quite ridiculous this, but Mikel Arteta has had his players videoed in training, balancing ballpoint pens between them. So I mean, practicing pens is something players do in training, but not usually this kind. They've also been sort of holding a football forehead to forehead. They look like sort of team building trust drills.
It sounds like the worst party games ever.
It really does. And in a couple of weeks where Arsenal lost the League Cup final to Manchester City, they then were knocked out of the FA Cup by Southampton. Arsenal fans had been dreaming of the quadruple, where they might have won four trophies this year. Now, they still look in command in the league, but the question is, are these sort of mentality questions about the side coming to the fore, and will they let the league title slip to Manchester City in this final run-in to the end of the season? They go to Sporting Lisbon tonight for the Champions League quarterfinal first leg. They will be hoping to keep their Champions League campaign alive, as well as closing out that Premier League season. But it's a really bizarre situation to have these videos coming out of them doing these weird drills in training, and will only add to the question marks around the team.
Finally, why could a few Deliveroo orders cost Samir Nasri more than €5 million?
Yeah, another truly bizarre story. Samir Nasri, the former Manchester City player, claims to live in Dubai, but in 2022, 200 Deliveroo orders arrived to his address in Paris. Which has led to the French authorities.
Over what kind of period of time? 200 orders over 1 year?
I think 200 in a year, right. Which is, you know,
that's
pretty substantial total. As a man who likes a Deliveroo, I'm not sure I've ever clocked 200 in a year. But Samir Nasri has, despite saying he lives in Dubai. So the French authorities have looked into this and now want €5.5 million in tax off him. Because, of course, in Dubai, there is no income tax. So he says he lives out there. He doesn't owe any. French officials say, well, why are you ordering all this takeaway food to your residence in Paris? Cough up. So we will see how that continues. But yeah, who would have thought Deliveroo could be so financially harmful to an ex-footballer?
Well, exactly. Thanks so much for that, Hugo. That's the sports journalist Hugo Chambray. If you want more on those stories, you can go to thetimes.com, head to the sports section. I did say earlier that there was a lot of you getting in touch, actually, sympathising with resident doctors. And I want to read this one out. I don't know who it's from, actually. I think someone with the initial R. My son has just completed 5 years of medical school. He now owes £95,000. If the supposed 6% interest is added to his debt this year, that's another £5,750. That's charged by the government just because he wanted to study medicine and help the NHS. Resident doctors, or newly qualified doctors, as they should be called, are burdened by huge stress, and as your guest said, they're forced to move to whatever area of the country the NHS says they will give them a job. There are often 25 applicants for one post-university job, and a lot of those have in the past been given to overseas applicants. West Reading is incapable of resolving this because he has no respect for junior doctors, says R. Next time you get in touch, stick your name on that. There's quite a few of you saying, actually, that unless you really understand it and you have these kind of people in your family, it's difficult to empathise. Right, it is now 3:31. Coming up, why getting beach body ready should no longer be the aim. First, we're going to get a check on the latest news headlines with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Wireless Festival has been cancelled and refunds will be issued to all ticket holders. It's the Home Office's decision to bar the headliner Kanye West from the UK and the subsequent pulling out of key sponsors. His booking came after he released songs celebrating Nazism before revoking them and apologising for anti-Semitism. Maxwell Marlowe, Director of Public Affairs at the Adam Smith Institute, told Times Radio he doesn't think it's the government's place to tell festival goers who they can book.
He's just done a sellout performance in California, sold out. I'm pretty sure everyone who went there weren't raging anti-Semites. And unless there is qualifying evidence that he was going to be a threat to the Public Order Act, specifically Section 4, then I don't think he should have been refused a visa. And I'd like to see the evidence from the Home Secretary fundamentally.
The Board of Deputies of British Jews said they would meet Kanye as part of his journey of healing, but only if the rapper cancelled performing at Wireless. We've had another threat from Donald Trump to Iran just hours before his deadline for it to reopen a key oil route expires. The US president warned a whole civilization will die tonight. Two people have been taken to hospital after a fire in Aberdeen. Properties have been evacuated in the Summerfield Terrace area. With growing criticism of the student loan system, there's a move to protect some from the potential hurt of inflation due to the Middle East conflict. Interest rates on Plan 2 and 3 agreements will be capped at 6% for a year from September. And it's been the hottest day of 2026 so far in England, Northern Ireland and Wales. You can expect it to be warmer for the majority tomorrow, but a colder spell kicks in on Thursday. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
McDonald's cards are here. 24 cards to find and free food in every pack. Choose from a range of cards meals, including the legendary Double Big Mac. Order a cards meal and get a pack today. 18 plus UK only with selected meals subject to availability. Ends 27th of April. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
This is Asma Mir on Times Radio. It's 3:34. Drive will be here with John Pienaar after 4 o'clock and I'm sitting in for Jane and Fee all week. Now, listen up if you want to know about strength training and all that kind of stuff. Back in May 2023, Elizabeth Davis went viral for a post on Instagram she had written, "Training for my summer body? F no, I'm training for my old lady body." Elizabeth is a former barrister turned fitness coach who is reshaping how women think about exercise. After leaving her legal career in her 30s, she retrained as a personal trainer and built a platform focused not on quick fixes or aesthetics, but on strength for the long term. And since then, she's inspired thousands of women with her evidence-based, no-nonsense approach to weight training. She's also the author of a new book, Train. I can't say all of this, actually, because it's got a rude word in it, but I'll go around it, Elizabeth. Training for Your Old Lady Body, An Honest, No Beep Guide to Help Women. And she's in the studio now. Good afternoon to you.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. So you train women to have a strong body at any age.
That's right.
For me, I always thought it was more important kind of in midlife as estrogen declines and bone mass decreases. But apparently, and I did not know this, what we do in our teens affects the rest of our bones for the rest of our lives. Can you just explain, first of all, where it all starts?
Yeah, so we reach peak bone mass, so the most bone mass we can accumulate, at around the age of 30. So you can think about it like paying deposits into a bank account. And we want to get to that point with as much bone saving as we can possibly get. And puberty is one of those times where we really want to be loading the skeleton to encourage the body to lay down more bone. The same with muscle, the same with strength. We see muscle and strength decline from the age of 30 unless we're proactive in trying to maintain it or trying to build it. So I always liken it to a bank account. We want to build as much as we can so that we've got a nice, healthy buffer to then see us through later life.
So if you don't do the right things, inverted commas, in your teenage years, which I don't think I did, what can happen?
Yeah, so you may have heard about osteoporosis.
Yes.
Osteoporosis.
You know what, only recently, only in the last maybe 4 or 5 years.
That's right. Same here. It was something that was not on my radar until my career change. Osteoporosis is the most common bone disease, and it's when the bone... The body doesn't make enough bone or loses too much bone. And osteoporosis doesn't usually show up until there's a fracture. So you kind of don't know you've got it. And this is one of the things that my book is pushing back against. For so long, we've kind of been fed this idea that fitness is for how we look, achieve a six pack, achieve a thigh gap. And under the surface, what is happening to our bone? What is happening to our muscle? We're kind of losing strength. But because those things aren't necessarily so visible, our focus is not on them. So it's not too late to build bone. You know, the body is responsive. The body simply responds to the demands we do or do not place on it. So if you don't load your bones, then the bone doesn't have that stimulus to adapt. But if you do start loading your bone, your body starts to kind of get the message, okay, I need to change.
Now, I mean, you're a perfect example here because I've seen you on Instagram lifting all sorts of weights, squat rack, etc. But I think, again, this is some this stuff is all available on your Instagram. You had an eating disorder in your teens. So how actually has that affected you in terms of your strength, in terms of your bone mass? And have you been able to reverse that in any way?
I've never had a DEXA scan. And that is the only way that I'll be able to kind of get a measurement on how my bone density is.
And why haven't you had that?
I just haven't got round to it, but it's on my list as something that I'd like to do. Though, of course, there is a bit of kind of, there's a bit of nerves there as well, you know, like what will it reveal? So it's something that's on my list that I'd like to do. Yeah, you know, having a period where I wasn't nourishing my body and where my periods stopped at a time where I was going through puberty wasn't ideal for my bone health. What I have done since then is kind of think, okay, what can I control? You know, I'm in a position now where I know better and I can do better. So we know that bone responds to higher strains, higher stress. So for me, that's the progressive strength training. And I know that you kind of refer to my Instagram and the heavy weights, but it doesn't start there.
Yeah,
you know, it's a journey and you need to start at a level that's right for you. And the key thing really is work at a level that's challenging for you and progress it as it starts to feel a bit easier. And that's how we get the body adapting continually. And then, you know, the higher impact stuff, the jumps, the bounds, the hops, that's the other way that we put a lot of strain through the skeleton to get the body to adapt. For me, this is one of the reasons why strength training has been so magic, because instead of focusing on, oh, I don't like that body part or I don't like this body part, I've just got this appreciation of all the things that my body can do and how adaptable my body is as long as I give it the kind of consistent, repeated, steady stimulus. Whereas before, the adaptation I was always changing was, oh, I want this part of me to look different.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, it's just so empowering to notice over a period of weeks, months, years, that things you used to find really hard, you can now do.
Yeah, we're going to get into all of that. You also said that it was kind of a joke that how weak you were.
Yeah.
Just explain that. What could you do or not do?
So before I started strength training, my arms were extremely thin. Mm. I look back at photos and there is very little muscle. And if I had continued not strengthening my upper body, you know, as the aging process were to do its thing and I was losing that 3 to 8% of muscle mass per decade, well, there wasn't a lot there to lose as far as I could see. Mm. So I never perceived having lack of upper body strength as a problem. Mm. You know, my problem areas that culture told me were my problem areas were my thighs.
Of course, I knew they'd be number one.
That's
many teenage girls.
That's it.
I mean, you're younger than me. You're in your early 40s, but I think perhaps a kind of generational thing how that used to be it.
Yes.
It's shifted now. It's different things, but it's the same message.
It's the same
I just
message.
Want to read this out. This comes from Jenny. I messed up my body in my teenage years with anorexia. I've been working on getting it back on track in my adult years. Do you advise anything as I move into my 40s?
So resistance training, progressive resistance training at least twice a week, where you are training all the main muscle groups. So don't just do the bits you like and skip the bits you don't like. We want a full body balanced program.
Bulgarian split squats. That's all I'm going to say.
Squats.
They're awful.
They are awful.
I hate them.
What I would say, though, again, if there's a movement you really, really hate,
split squats.
Yeah. There are other, you know, so what we're doing there, we're training a knee dominant movement. So you could do a regular split squat. You could do some kind of step up, you know, there's leg press machine. So there's always, you don't have to hate your way through an exercise. But for me, there's a weird sense of satisfaction with the Bulgarian split squat.
I know.
It's like, yes, I've got better at that. But they never, that's the thing about strength training. It never gets easier because as soon as it's easier, you make it a bit harder. You add some more reps, you increase weight, you do a deficit Bulgarian split squat. It just, the fun never ends. So I would say cardio as well to the listener who has messaged in. For me, I had a difficult relationship with cardio because my fitness used to be hours on a treadmill, hours on an elliptical, just watching the calorie monitor. But if we're training for our old lady bodies, heart health, lung health, really, really important.
Yeah.
So I would suggest to your listener, find a way of training cardio that is enjoyable, that doesn't have any kind of triggering or negative associations. I love walking. You know, I love getting out in the fresh air, walking, winter or sunshine. It just makes me so happy. For me, the higher intensity cardio is a little bit trickier simply because it kind of can take me to a bit more of a negative place where I used to use exercise as a punishment.
Yeah, it feels kind of old fashioned almost in a way to me. I'm not saying cardio is not useful, but when you do see people on there, you do your workout and you come back and they're still on there, you think, is this good? I don't know. I don't know what it's doing for you. Obviously, everybody's different.
I think sometimes it's what feels most accessible. For me, previously, you know, I would walk into a gym and the weights area looked scary.
Yeah.
And for me, the safe spaces were either the studio where there was some kind of group class going on or a cardio machine. And it just felt like a really accessible way for me to do fitness. So I think, you know, if that feels like the thing that you can do, it's worthwhile doing. But it's always worth just probing your why and asking, is what I'm doing in the interests of current and future me?
Yeah.
Or am I kind of punishing myself with this?
You said this amazing thing. Now, where is it? It's this idea of, you know, there's a real kind of anti-aging push, isn't there, on you see it everywhere, not just skincare, but also in terms of women's bodies and probably men's too, on social media. And it's this idea of, yes, you might look younger, but that doesn't say that you're aging well.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite a shift, actually, for people because, look, I mean, I'll admit it too. I care less than I used to, but I still do care. I think at the same level as I care about how strong I am, I also care about what size I am and where I fit and all the rest of it. I mean, it's become more of a struggle as you move into your 50s. But how do you, you've got a lot of followers, but how easy is it to get that message across, do you think, in 2026?
I exist in a bit of an echo chamber in that the people who follow me are there for the message. So it's perhaps a bit skewed, but I do think that we are on the cusp of a shift. I think that's why that post went viral, because I think
the summer body thing is.
Yes.
You know what I feel so bad about? There are so many women, and again, there might be men too, and it gets to about March or April, and that's this dread starts, this cold dread starts for some women of, oh no, I need to start now, you know, getting ready for summer.
Yeah.
And actually, just imagine if you didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
If instead you were just going to the gym and lifting heavy weights or whatever it was, doing Bulgarian split squats, you know, and not having to worry about that. How liberating would that be? But that's a difficult place to get to.
It's because that is what we are fed year after year, because somebody is making money from making us feel that before we can strip off and show our bodies in swimwear, we need a complete overhaul. So if anybody is at this time of year feeling that way, that's just because that's what's been fed to you probably your entire life for as long as you can remember.
Mm.
What is interesting is that actually we can't judge a lot from someone's muscle mass, bone health, strength, aerobic capacity, mental health from how they look in a swimsuit. You know, so often we're shown photos of celebrities and it says ex celebrity picture of health at 65. Well, actually what you're showing me is a slim celebrity in a bikini. I can't make an assessment on most of those things as to how that person's aging based on what they look in a swimsuit. But this is what we're fed. Six pack is synonymous with health.
Yeah.
If the person has a six pack, then they must be healthy.
Yeah, but will they be able to get up without using their hands from the floor when they're 70 or 80?
Will they break a bone if they fall? You know, there is a bigger picture that I think for so long has been overlooked.
What should we be aiming to do when we have an old, when we actually have the old lady body, whatever that, you know, might be? And I know you mean that affectionately.
Yeah.
When we're in our 50s or 60s or 70s or 80s beyond, what are there things that we should maybe be aiming for in terms of what we can do or what we can lift?
Yeah. So I would always say this is going to depend on what you need to be able to do. So in the book, I invite everybody to go on an old lady body daydream where you consider all the things that you need to be able to do now.
Yes.
Wheeling the bins out. Yeah. Carrying the laundry around the house, reaching up to get the Le Creuset off a tour, all those things. But then also your extracurriculars. Like, what do you love doing? For me, I've mentioned the walking, but it's not just walking. There are heavy gates that I need to be able to pull. There are stiles that I need to be able to climb over. There are cows that I need to be able to run from. So for me, that's the benchmark. It's not about saying every woman should be able to deadlift her body weight.
Yeah.
It's about saying, what do you want to be able to do when you're 80? And what can you do now to preserve that? Because if you're finding something tricky now at the age of 40 or 50, I've got some sad news. It's not going to magically get easier.
Mm.
You know, if you're finding something tricky when you're 40, it's not magically going to be easy when you're 80. So it's about looking, I guess, where your weaker spots are and focusing on those. So for me, my upper body strength, I used to joke about it. Actually, that was a big looming red flag for me.
Yeah.
Now I've worked on it and I can do pull-ups, I can do push-ups, and life just feels so much easier.
Yeah.
Like, what was going on?
There's a lot of people getting in touch, mostly women, but some men too. Kate says, I think I would choose a Bulgarian split squat over a burpee though. Yes, burpees are evil. Tansy, skipping high impact, high cardio can be done daily in the house. Susie, old woman training, I stayed tuned in. I've just come back from a one-to-one session at the gym. I'm 78.
Yes.
I am an old lady with an old lady body, not you youngsters. Well, you know, old lady body.
But it's aspirational. Exactly.
Exactly.
This is why the book is Training for Your Old Lady Body, because it's a privilege to get older. Yeah. It's a gift. Why are we frightened of it? Why aren't we embracing it? Why aren't we training for it? I salute, you know, anybody who says, oh, I've already got the old lady body, but they're, you know, they're living and they're training and they're capable. Mm-hmm. I see them as role models. I see them as inspirational.
Yeah. You said, one of the things you said on social media that really struck with me was, you said, I was primed to panic about cellulite, but never educated about osteoporosis. And many people will recognize this. Again, yes. It depends on the culture that you grew up in, the time you grew up in. Does social media help? Because I obviously came across you on social media and I thought, okay, this is, you know, this is my vibe. But I have to say, there is so much information out there that I actually find quite confusing. Mm. What do you think, it's helping or hindering?
I think that there is a lot of misinformation, and the nature of social media is that misinformation can then spread very, very quickly. So it's a tricky one. I think, you know, for me, it has been really positive. And if I am able to continue to push back against this kind of typical fitness messaging and even get one person to think a little bit differently yeah. about what movement can mean for them, then that for me is a win. Ultimately, I'll control the bits that I can. I can't control what everybody else is posting, but I can control what I put out. Mm. And hopefully that will make a bit of a difference.
Yeah. Do you understand that there are some people who will be saying, hang on a minute, we want both. We want to be slim and toned or whatever the word is, but we also want to be strong. Is it possible to do both?
Yeah, this is where it's really interesting, because I think a lot of people do have aesthetic goals. A lot of people want to look a particular way or be a particular size.
Yeah.
What I would say is that we all need to just be aware that this idea of how we should look has very much been fed to us. Beauty standards are always going to be around and they are always going to be moving. So in that sense, it's a moving target. The goalposts are always moving.
Yeah.
And that's why I prefer to focus on strength, muscle, power, independence, longevity, because they'll be telling me I should be thin. They'll be telling me I should be lean but muscled. And I'm never going to be able to keep up with what they are saying. The other thing that I have noticed is that actually the more I focus on performance and just using my body and enjoying my body and challenging myself a little bit, actually my focus on the aesthetics and how much I care about the aesthetics gets less and less. I'm not saying it ever properly goes away, but I just feel like my eyes have been opened to this bigger picture.
Yeah.
And once that happens, it kind of gives you a bit more perspective. So if I find myself looking in the mirror and criticizing my cellulite,
still happens.
Yeah, which it does happen. I'd be lying to say it doesn't. Yeah. But I can quickly ground myself. I can quickly ground myself and say, what would old lady Elizabeth say? Old lady Elizabeth would be saying, oh, come on, like, for sake. Yes. You don't need to be worrying about that. Like, their life is for so much more than that.
Just very quickly, coming to end the interview, but apparently there was a bit of pushback with the word old in the title of your book.
Yes, there was a bit of pushback. So
not from your current publisher.
No, my current publisher, Bonnier, are amazing, and they got the book straight away. Another publisher who loved the book, loved the proposal and wanted the book, requested that the title should be changed, because the books with the word old in the title don't sell, because old is not aspirational. To which I say,
it's inevitability.
It's an inevitability if we're lucky.
Yeah.
You know, we're aging every day.
Old is not aspirational.
It's not aspirational. So I think, you know, that says a lot, doesn't it, about our cultural mindset.
It does. It absolutely does, on so many levels. Elizabeth, it's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
And put a face to the Instagram account and to hear about your book. Thank you so much for all of you asking Her name is Elizabeth Davis. She's on Instagram as This Woman Lifts. And the book is Training for Your Old Lady Body, an honest no beep guide to help women. And it's out now. Thank you so much to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Right, this is Times Radio and it's 3:56.
Times Radio Market Watch, in association with Eden Tree Investment Management. Elevate your specialist knowledge with Times Radio's essential roundup of the latest financial news from all the global stock markets. Hear analysis, credible insight, and up-to-the-minute information to help maximise your investment portfolio. Market Watch, throughout the day on Times Radio, in association with Eden Tree Investment Management. Sustainable investing, elevated. Search Eden Tree to find out more. Capital at risk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Right now, a guide dog puppy is taking her very first steps. One day, she'll help someone with sight loss live a full and independent life.
Find the crossing, Bess. Good girl.
When you sponsor a puppy with guide dogs, you're there for it all. Her wobbly walks, her first harness, the life-changing partnership. It's more than a donation. It's the start of a life-changing story. Search Sponsor a Guide Dog Puppy and be part of a story you'll be proud to share.
Guide dogs.
Global events.
We're going to start, though, with the influence that China is having on all of us.
Breaking news.
We're going to throw a lot of light, I hope, on what at the moment is a story with so many unknowns.
Reactive analysis.
He called her the most insidious form of politician. He hates her.
From the world's best journalists.
I wrote a piece recently wondering if we'd become kind of ungovernable.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
There's a lot of you getting in touch about our interview with Elizabeth Davis, who is on Instagram as This Woman Lifts, because you're asking questions and I'm not able to answer them, actually, but she'll be able to. Kate, your question, you're a 56-year-old woman who's also hypermobile. Just like my daughter, actually. She's hypermobile. What about me in weight training? Make sure that you ask her on Instagram. Mick, I'm a 64-year-old man who hasn't used a gym for over 20 years before joining a new local one on the 6th of January. I go 5 days a week and I mix spin classes with weights and I absolutely love it and I feel great. Darren, I did my first Ironman aged 47 and my second last year at the age of 51. There's so many of you getting in touch here, actually. Kevin also saying, I agree totally with your guest, Elizabeth. I am 68 and whenever I do not feel like going out on my bike or to the gym, I say to myself, money in the bank. So that gives you an idea, really, of the kind of thing we're talking about. I think the thing that comes out of that for me most of all is hopefully that there is going to be a shift with some people, not just women, but with some people about actually just looking forward to how you are going to be able to move and lift things and cope when you are in your 60s, your 70s, whenever it may be, because you can look amazing and young and toned and slim and all the rest of it. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are aging well. And perhaps that's what we need to look at. But thanks so much of you, so much, so many of you getting in touch. Right, that is it from me. I'm back tomorrow from 2. Producer was Felix Forbes. Technical operator was Ryan Boyden. And up next, it's John Pienaar with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Asma. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. The Wireless Festival has been cancelled and refunds will be issued to all ticket holders after the Home Office's decision to bar the headliner Kanye West from the UK. And Donald Trump has issued a warning in a social media post just hours before his deadline for it to reopen a key oil route expires. And the former US Middle East negotiator Aaron David Miller is going to be joining me as we count down to President Trump's deadline for Iran. And with doctors now on day one of a six-day strike, we'll be talking to the chair of the NHS Alliance. That's Victor Adebowale.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Wireless Festival has been cancelled after its headliner, Kanye West, was blocked from entering the UK. The Home Office cancelled the rapper's entry permit on the grounds that his presence would not be conducive to the public good. It follows years of anti-Semitic and racist remarks from the artist. He apologised for his previous behaviour earlier this year, attributing it to manic episodes linked to bipolar disorder. Rosie Phillips is Deputy CEO at Bipolar UK and says this link isn't helpful.
What we have to remember is saying that you have a kind of condition like bipolar as an explanation for behaviours isn't really helpful, isn't misleading, and actually trivialises quite a lot, which is a really significant mental health condition. This has been bubbling for a number of years with his kind of attributing some of the behaviour to bipolar, and I think you have to step away from separating sometimes what is behaviour or poor behaviour and what is bipolar, and I think it does oversimplify it to some degree.
Donald Trump has warned a whole civilization will die tonight unless Iran reaches a deal on reopening the Strait of Hormuz. There are just 9 hours to go before his deadline. Meanwhile, the US has carried out new strikes on military targets on Iran's key oil export terminal, Karg Island. Sarah Baxter is the director of the Mary Colvin Center for International Reporting and says there is a sense of dread.
I did wake up with something of a pit in my stomach with this concept of the doomsday clock ticking. And it feels a kind of Armageddon-like this morning because Trump's threat to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age, you know, it's only got a few hours to go. And indeed, you know, the first skirmishes or worse may have already started in the Strait of Hormuz.
Meanwhile, the cost of an oil barrel is now around £83, up more than 50% since the Iran war started. The head of the International Energy Agency has called it the worst oil crisis in history. The co-founder and former CEO of the fast food restaurant chain Leon has told Times Radio the hospitality industry is being killed by the government. The sector's warning that there'll be staff cuts and reduced trading hours due to higher energy prices sparked by the Iran war. That's on top of other rising costs for the sector. John Vincent says the chain says the high street is dead.
This is actually a complete and utter disaster, this government. I have people calling me in tears every day saying they've owned restaurants for 40 years and now they're going under. In America, there's 6% sales tax to 7% sales tax. In the UK, it's 20% VAT. In America, 6% of total expenditure is rent. Here, it's about 15%. So when you add all that up, it is impossible now to run a hospitality business.
A long-standing Waitrose employee who was sacked after tackling a shoplifter has been offered a job at a rival supermarket chain. Walker Smith confronted a shoplifter who was attempting to steal a bag of Easter eggs. Waitrose then dismissed him. Now the chairman of Iceland, Lord Richard Walker, has said Mr. Smith is welcome to a job with us. The top temperature of the year so far of 22.9 degrees Celsius has been set in Wales. England and Northern Ireland have seen highs too, and Scotland will likely have joined them by the end of the day. Forecasters say tomorrow will be warmer for most before things cool down again from Thursday. For a roundup of news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
Hello and welcome to you on Drive on Times Radio with me, John Pienaar. Thanks for your company. Now, 9 hours and counting down before President Trump orders a cataclysmic aerial attack on Iran, a country in which every power plant and every bridge would be a target, he says. An attack which Trump says would set Iran's infrastructure back by a century. An attack which would also be a war crime, and an attack about which President Trump says he doesn't care if it's a war crime or not. The president's latest social media post just a couple of hours ago was astonishing, even by Donald Trump's standards. A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, he said. I don't want that to happen, but it probably will. We will get the thoughts of one of America's most senior former military commanders a bit later, live here on the programme. It will be fascinating to see what General Ben Hodges, who served as NATO Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, makes of Donald Trump's ever-changing ideas on the war and how to end it. Could Trump possibly have been serious when he said he wanted to see America charging and collecting tolls for tankers and ships using the vital Strait of Hormuz? That's the vital sea route that's now effectively blocked and controlled by Iran. Well, I'm guessing, strongly guessing, that Aaron David Miller, America's former Middle East peace negotiator, will consider Trump's idea of handing the job of guarding shipping on the Strait to other countries and then demanding payment to America for passage. Well, that idea to be absurd. Let us see. But we can also get Aaron David Miller's judgment as America and Israel hammers Iran's military power on who is actually winning the war in the long term, in strategic terms, which is a pretty vital question. It is also possible the president simply stops the clock on that countdown a bit later on. He's done that, but what is it, three times already? There is no sign at all of Iran yielding to President Trump's terms, whether it's reopening the Hormuz Strait and effectively capitulating or other demands. But we will check on that. And I wonder what you are thinking. Send me a text, 8722, stop with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Firstly, President Trump saying on social media, a whole civilization will die tonight. Here is the whole Truth Social post, voiced by one of our production team.
A whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. I don't want that to happen, but it probably will. However, now we have a complete and total regime change where different, smarter and less radicalized minds prevail. Maybe something revolutionary wonderful can happen. Who knows? We will find out tonight, one of the most important moments in the long and complex history of the world. 47 years of extortion, corruption and death will finally end. God bless the great people of Iran.
The words there of President Trump on Truth Social. Let's now, first of all, welcome to the programme, Catherine Philp, The Times World Affairs Editor. Hello to you, Catherine.
Hi, John.
Hi. So here we are again on the brink of a massive escalation of the war by President Trump. Unless, of course, Catherine, stops the clock, which on precedent is, I suppose, still possible.
It is still possible, but let's not forget this is a hot war. So there are things going on all the time anyway. The question is, does he escalate in the manner that he's talking about? The Truth Social post is frankly nonsensical. You can't vow to wipe out a whole civilization and then say God bless the Iranian people who are the inheritors of one of the longest running continuous civilizations in the world. So that makes no sense. He has said that this is the day that they will hit the bridges and the power plants. That could happen. We've already seen Israel hit railways today. But even Israel, interestingly,